Good morning. We're going to start just a little bit early. Angelina has a really cool presentation she's going to give here real fast. So without further ado, take the stage.
Hi, my name is Angelina, and I'm going to do a presentation on geodes, which are the rocks you see here. They're basically a cavity that's filled with minerals that crystallize around like the crevices, and over time it like builds up on each other. So crystals are, like I said, essentially forming hollow cavities by gases inside and having minerals build on each other. And they can be mainly built, they're mainly made two ways, through volcanoes and sedimentary rocks. So in volcanoes, when the lava flows, like when after an active volcano exploded, lava flows and there's carbon dioxide and water vapors in the bubbles of the magma. And these bubbles make cavities of trapped air, and when the lava hardens and weathering happens, the water brings in minerals that would crystallize in the cavities over time, and water would go in, back, and in and out until a whole crystallized inside is made. And sedimentary rocks are found usually in limestones and stuff like that. And it's made when organic material like tree branches and roots decay, and it leaves a hollow inside. And after, like what I said, weathering, stuff like that, brings in materials to crystallize the hollow cavities, and that would leave like the pretty insides that we see today. Some materials that can be left behind are like quartz, opal, and carbonic materials. The different geodes that are made are really dependent on the location of where they're formed, the pH, and stuff like that. So this is a visual example of what of the volcano example. So lava flows, and this is the gas bubble, and the water comes in, and it forms the crystals inside the cavity. And it takes like 1,000 years to form, really. And this is a picture of the geodes before. They're like chemically treated to until you see this. And the before and after is really that they get polished and they're soaked in dyed chemicals to give them the vibrant colors that we see. So we wouldn't really see this in like nature and stuff. So one of the biggest geodes ever found is the Crystal Cave, and it was discovered in 1897, and it measures about 35 feet in diameter. You can actually take a tour in it. You can like walk in it and look around. It's in Idaho, and it's owned by a winery. And I don't think we have time for the video. Another one is in Spain. This one looks a lot more cooler because the crystals are sharper and more clear, and it's a little smaller. About 26 feet in diameter. They want to make this into a tourist spot, but because of like the sharp edges, it's kind of like hard to do that because someone might get hurt. And this is a visual of how big it is. So you can go through this entering, and then this is like one person. You can fit like about 6 other people, but it's going to be pretty cramped. And as you can see, it's like hard to get tourists in and out. And
nice job. Any questions? Very cool. That's kind of cool about the dive. I didn't realize how to do that.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Well done. I'll send it out. All right, so give me a second to change over. Okay. Before we start today's lecture, I do want to remind you that this week in lab will be the week of the final lab. And the final lab, again, is nothing more than the two labs we've just done, the group one and the group three together. So there'll be no surprises or anything like that. The time of the final lab will also be different. Most of you in Tuesday morning's lab will meet Tuesday at 8 o'clock. All these times we'll meet in the lab room, by the way. Tuesday afternoon, please remember that your time is most different. It'll be at 2:30. There's a lab in there until 2 o'clock, and I'll need a couple minutes to set up. So we will meet at 2:30 in 2507. So from 1:10 to 2:30, just hang out. And then on Wednesday, I have two sections. If you're in Wednesday's lab, most of you, I think, will come Wednesday at 2:30. But I do have some people now that are going to be there at noon. So whichever section and stuff you signed up for, if you don't know, you can email me. Also, I'd rather have you just show up than not show up at all. So just show up and stuff. Very important. Whatever time you come, though, remember that we will meet in 2507, not 2501. When you do come to the final lab, you'll turn in problem set number 6, take home quiz number 6, which is Scantron only, the QA3 lab we did last week. You'll also turn in your lab notebook. And also, when you come, bring the combined flowchart, your goggles, don't wear open-toed shoes, and definitely bring the lab instructions from the group 1 and group 3 labs. This is not a lab that you have to memorize anything. You'll have these instructions in front of you. So make sure you bring those things. You can use them during the time. These times are very definite. All right, everyone will be done by 10:30, et cetera, et cetera. However, most of you will not need the full time. You'll see that using a combination of your own skills for these labs and sometimes just luck too, that most people are done 1.5 to 2 hours. Any questions on this kind of stuff? All right. So the last section here we're looking at is how to name these coordination compounds. And the names get really wild. Like at first when you look at these things, you're like, what the heck, Russell? All right. And I understand if you say that or other words, which I can't say in my supposedly G-rated class. So if you look at these, what you want to do is you want to break them down. The ligands, which are the parts after the metals, usually are listed first. In this case, this thing right here is called ethylene diamine. And normally, you would use di, tri, tetra, the same Greek prefixes we've used. However, if the ligand name has a Greek prefix in it already, like ethylene diamine, and down here we'll see triphenylphosphine, those are both Greek prefixes, then you need to use the alternate system, which I call bis, tris, tetrakis. There's a whole bunch of these different names, and you put whatever it is with the Greek prefix in parentheses. If you said triethylene diamine, it might sound like you had 3 ethylenes and 2 amines, but that's not the case in this molecule. You have 3 ethylene diamines, so that's the reason for this alternate system. So in this case, you'd go tris, ethylene, diamine, nickel, 2. This is a positive 2. Ethylene diamine has no charge. You could draw out a Lewis structure for it, and everything would have the perfect number of electrons, etc., etc. This compound right here, which is also known as Vasquez compound, this one has more ligands. It has 2 triphenylphosphines, which is what that is, and that's this part right here, bis triphenylphosphine. There's also a carbon monoxide, which is called carbonyl in this world, and a chlorine. So carbonyl alphabetically comes before chloro, so carbonyl chloro, bis triphenylphosphine, iridium 1. Now triphenylphosphine is neutral, so is CO, but chloride is almost always negative 1. This iridium has to balance that. That's why there's an iridium plus 1. Kazuntite. Any questions on these things? All right, so here's another example. We left with this on Friday, but let's do it again here too. This compound has 2 ammonias and 2 chlorines. All right. Nickel is oftentimes four coordinate, which means it has four pieces around it. So we'll put all of these pieces before the nickel. There's two chlorines and two ammonias. What is the fancy name for ammonia when it comes to these complexes?
Amine.
Amine, well done. Amine has two M's, which is weird, but anyway, I'm just the messenger. Amine comes before chloro, so it would be diamine dichloro. It's nickel. Each chlorine is negative one, so there's a positive two nickel to balance those two negative ones. This one would be answer D. Okay. Any questions so far? Yeah.
Why did you say that nickel came last?
Oh, the metal center is always listed last. It's like all the pieces connected to the metal center go first, Rebecca, and then the metal goes last and stuff. So I'll show you some examples where sometimes the nickel is not last, but this is like one big thing. All right, so that's why it's all together with the metal last. We'll come back to what Rebecca said in a second. Okay, now this is an example of a complex ion coordinated with an anion, and what that really means is that there's no charge on this thing. It's not positive or negative. But like we've seen already, chlorine is usually negative one. One of these chlorines is inside the square brackets. So going back to what Rebecca just said, we're going to put this chlorine and these five ammonias before the cobalt. But this part right here is outside. This part is kind of like magnesium chloride, all right? There's two negative one Cl's to balance everything inside there. So the naming for this one is a little bit different. You want to put the five ammonias, which like Melissa said was amine, pentaamine, and the one chlorine that's inside there before the cobalt. So this would be pentaamine chlorocobalt. There's a total of three chlorides, so that means this is a cobalt plus three to balance it. But notice here how only one chlorine is inside and the rest of them are outside. This is a true positive-negative ionic compound, like potassium hydride. In this case, there's a space between the cation and the anion. Only the chlorines that are on the complex ion go in the first part and the other ones go outside. Okay. Here's kind of the opposite of what this last one was. This one had a positive coordinate compound first and then an anion. Here we have a cation followed by a negative complex ion. Now, this is cadmium, Cd, and if cadmium or any metal is part of the negative anion, you change that cadmium name to an A-T-E ending, we're going to call this cadmate, which is really strange. So if you see a metal listed as zinc 8, cadmate, silverite, one time I saw, that just means that the metal is involved in the anion. So instead of having something like K2O, potassium oxide, this is going to be potassium with a space, and then this thing is after it. Now, cyanide is called cyano when it comes to these. This thing is going to be potassium for those two. Tetracyano means four cyanides. There's no net charge, and each cyanide is negative one. There's two positive one potassiums. This is a cadmium plus two, but again, we're changing cadmium to cadmate because it's part of the anion. So this crazy thing, potassium tetracyano cadmate two. Okay, yeah.
So the position of the potassium or the chloride ion that's on the outside of the bracket is going to determine where it goes in the naming?
Yes, that's right. Like we didn't, Noah brings up a good point. Like we didn't call this one up here a trichlorocobalt 3. There was like a separate chloride outside. And Noah, you're right. It's these chlorides are outside, so it's like its own thing. Just like these potassiums are outside too. Excellent. Here's another one. Now this one, there's no square brackets, but everything is like next to the nickel. So what that means for us here is that you can think about this as having like a square brackets around it. This one has two chlorines and two ethylene diamines, but we don't call it dichlorodiethylene diamine because ethylene diamine has a di in there. So this one we'll put a bis next to, dichlorobis ethylene diamine nickel 2. It's nickel 2 because each chlorine is negative 1. The nickel 2 will cancel that out and make it neutral. This one is very near and dear to my heart because in graduate school this was like a starting material for a lot of the things we use. Now this beast right here, C4H8O, is not a compound you need to know, but it's called tetrahydrofuran. And believe it or not, I kind of got used to the smell of this solvent. But anyway, I digress, and you don't need to know my chemical dependency, Your Honor. Anyway, so this is a type of a coordination compound, all right? Notice the tetra, all right? Can we use regular Greek prefixes, or do we have to use the alternate form? Alternate, that's right. So because this has a Greek prefix tetra, we can't use monodi-tri, we'll have to use the bis tris tetrakis. Because there's three of these guys, it's going to be a tris tetrahydrofuran. Chlorine comes before tetra, so chlorine will be first. That'll be a three chlorines. And three negative ones, what's going to be the charge on this chromium if this guy is neutral? Positive 3. Well done. So this thing is going to be trichlorotris tetrahydrofuran chromium 3. I usually refer to it just as the purple stuff, hopefully for obvious reasons. That's way too many syllables and letters. However, the official name, which you can't find in my thesis, trichlorotris tetrahydrofuran chromium 3. Whoopie doo. Questions? Good. Anyway, this next compound is actually famous because it was used as a way to isolate pure nickel. In the old days, it was hard to get pure nickel, but using this compound, they were actually able to do it. Now, this is an iron, obviously, and this is CO. Does anybody remember what the fancy name for carbon monoxide is in this world?
Carbonyl,
well done. They call carbon monoxide carbonyl in this stuff. It's different than the carbonyl from organic chemistry, which was the C double bond O bond. But anyway, carbon monoxide is a neutral molecule. So if you look at this, nothing here has a charge, all right? Everything is zero. So this is going to be an iron zero compound, all right? There is no charge to it. And carbonyl does not have a Greek prefix to it, so we can use just regular kind of good old Greek prefixes. Pentacarbonyl means 5 COs and iron zero. So this is actually an example of neutral iron. Carbon monoxide comes in stuff, bonds to it pretty quickly. This is also a reason why carbon monoxide is a bad poison to us. The same apparatus that allows iron to bond to oxygen can really bond super well, better actually than oxygen, to carbon monoxide, and then it breaks down our oxygen transport, blah, blah, blah. Any questions on this? So if you see these compounds, all right, at first I still find them like, all right, but I try to break it down. Remember the Greek prefixes, which have served us well since Chem 221. Some of the names are weird, like carbonyl is CO and amine is ammonia, but they're not unbearable, especially for this kind of overview we're doing here. This is probably arguably one of the most famous of these compounds. It's called cisplatinum. And cisplatinum is still an anti-cancer drug that's being used, which is kind of crazy. The central atom is a platinum. These are both chlorines, and these are both ammonias. They call this a cis form because the ammonias are right next to each other, just like the chlorines are. You can also make the trans form, where the chlorines would be 100 180 versus 90 degrees. This is also a little different from organic chemistry, where we had a double bond. If the atoms were on the same side but opposite carbons, we called it cis. And if they were opposite, we called it trans. This is the inorganic version of cis and trans. And the cis one is very active, which is kind of cool. They refer to it as platinol AQ, and there's several derivatives of it and stuff, but it's kind of cool. Platinum to the rescue. Now, the last thing we're going to talk about real fast is the idea of isomers. And earlier I mentioned cis and trans. In organic chemistry, that was really important for differentiating the reactivity of things. So usually trans forms were less polar than cis forms, and so the reactions were different. In these kind of complexes, you also have these kind of questions to bring up, but there's a whole bigger spectrum of things you can do. Isomers are super important in chemistry. They will become more important to you if you continue on with chemistry than they have been so far. Like in organic chemistry, knowing the polarity of things is usually a reflection of isomers, and there's other kinds of things we'll talk about very briefly here. There's all these different kinds of isomers. The main one that we've focused on in this class so far has been a geometric isomer, specifically cis and trans. Geometric isomers, we're going to see same numbers of atoms, but their geometry is different. So instead of having things both up, then one is up and one is down and stuff. But in inorganic chemistry, there's other types too, these coordination, sphere, linkage, and stereoisomers. There's also mare and fac, which we'll talk about just real briefly here. So just like cis and trans are important in organic chemistry, these other types are super important as you get higher in chemistry classes as well. Coordination sphere is really interesting, and it goes back to what Rebecca and I were talking about, I think, or Noah. My mind is clear sometimes. I don't know where I am. But anyway, there's a difference if the ligand is connected directly to the metal or outside. It was Noah, sorry. Anyway, and the reactivity can actually be quite different. So let me show you two examples. These are both cobalt complexes. They both have five ammonias, but notice the subtleties here. Chlorine is inside the bracket and bromine is outside, and here it's reversed. Bromine is on the inside and chlorine is on the outside. Now, usually the piece in the brackets is a little bit more stable and harder to react than the piece that's outside. This is an example of what they call coordination sphere isomers, all right? So in the first case here, the bromide will be much more reactive than the chloride, and in the second one, the chloride will be more reactive than the bromide. Most transition metals, again, like to have six dentate parts around them, and so once the six is full, then anything that's left over will be on the outside. So let's say that we place these complexes in water, all right? The complex ion will stay together, and the counter ion will then go and drift apart. So bromide would be flipping around in solution in this one, and in the second one, you'd have chloride moving around. So again, notice that it's the position where they are. This one's connected directly to the cobalt. This is a true ionic, positive-negative kind of interaction. So if we add silver nitrate to both of these, we're going to get different products. Silver loves to react with bromide and chloride. All right, it's one of the silver lead mercury ions from group one. With the first complex, you'd end up with silver bromide as a solid, and you'd have like nitrate, some kind of counter ion right there. In the second one, though, you'd have silver chloride. So it does make a difference, like where these pieces are. It's very difficult to tell these apart. The molar mass is the same. Polarity is often a little different, but sometimes you need to do a chemical test like this to actually see what's happening. Linkage isomers are still things that I think are kind of science fiction, but there's been enough literature work done now that apparently these are real. These two complexes here have the same formula, all right? A cobalt, five ammonias, and some kind of NO2. But notice how this one right here is listed ONO. This one is listed NO2. And the reason for it is that the metal center is connecting to the first one at the oxygen and the second one at the nitrogen. And they call them different things. Now, for a long time, I thought, oh, this is ludicrous. You can't make that much of a difference. Electronegativity, I had all these arguments. But the literature has kind of made me think otherwise here. This is a great example of the linkage isomers. And if you just physically look at these, this is kind of a yellow and this is kind of a red. And I thought, oh, yeah, they've been oxidized or, you know, my tetrahydrofuran was in there or something. But no, it's apparently real. So this is a stable complex where cobalt bonds with nitrogen, which is honestly what I would expect. This is the regular nitro group. But cobalt can also apparently react with the oxygen and make a stable group. They call this the nitrito, which is hard for me to say. But anyway, this is another weird kind of geometry difference that you can run into. It's mostly where nitrogen and oxygen are both there. Like if you have just oxygen and carbon, oxygen dominates, all right? But if you have a compound, a ligand, where nitrogen and oxygen are both there, you can get into these kind of things. Morgan, I know you're not here in class, but she's in Wednesday's group, but there's a sulfur nitrogen compound where this has also been known too, which is kind of cool. So if Morgan's listening or watching, she can. All right, prop that back on. It's almost spring, summer. This is the one that we're most familiar with, but we're going to see some variations, and these are the geometric isomers. So again, same numbers of atoms, but different arrangement in space. We've seen cis and trans a lot, all right? Cis and trans were used in organic chemistry. But there's also cis and trans, and ismer, in fact, in square, planar, and octahedral complexes. So we saw the cis platinum, where the atoms were at 90 degrees versus 180. And then if you have three atoms that are the same, you can have mer and fac. So I'll show you some examples of these just so that you know what they are. And if you see cis, trans, or even now mer and fac, you'll know that it has something to do with geometry. These guys have definitely different properties. All right, there's a big difference between a trans fat and a cis fat. You can see all the warnings and stuff on labels for trans fat. They're not good for our bodies, while supposedly cis fats are better. Same kind of things can happen in chemistry where you have differences here. Here's the cis platinum and the trans platinum, which is not talked about as much. The cis form in my world is at 90 degrees, while the trans would be 180 degrees apart. These are examples of square planar platinum complexes. There would be a lone pair above and below the platinum if we were to figure that out. But in this case, just realize that they are different. Their polarity would be different. Of these two, which one would you expect to be more non-polar? Good. Trans, that's right. If the ligands are opposite each other, then they kind of cancel out. So like these two ammonias would kind of cancel out, and these two chlorines would kind of cancel out. We would expect this to be more nonpolar, arguably nonpolar totally. This one, on the other hand, there's no way that these two ammonias will cancel each other out, or these two chlorines. Here's octahedral complexes with cis and trans, and this pops up quite a bit. Here's two chlorines at 90 degrees, and here's two chlorines at 180 degrees. So again, you can probably see from the right example here, these chlorines will cancel each other the way they pull electrons. These waters will cancel, and these two waters will cancel. They're all at 180. But when it comes to the quote-unquote cis form, this chlorine and this water, they will pull differently, all right? It doesn't matter for where we are which one pulls more, but they do pull differently. Same thing with these two. This would be a non-polar interaction probably. But anyway, this is pretty common when you have these octahedral complexes and two of the pieces are the same. Now, mare and fac are kind of like cis and trans for octahedral complexes. Both mare and fac, you have to have three ligands which are the same. So you could imagine in these examples here that yellow is chlorine and blue is water, something like that, all right? And if you look at this one right here, the fac, all of the yellow, dark blue atom, yellow interactions, they're all 90 degrees. There's no 180 degree angles. So nothing over here is going to have that opposite 180 effect to cancel out. This one's going to be super polar, all right? But if you look long enough at the mirror, let's look at the light blue, the quote-unquote waters. We've got at least one water, dark atom, water interaction at 180 degrees. That would be essentially nonpolar. And there's also, if you look at it spinning around there, there's a yellow central atom, yellow, which is also 180 degrees. So mare is much less polar than the fac. They're both polar, but again, the degree of polarity is much greater in the fac than the mare. Fac stands for facial. There's like a plane between the three atoms that are the same. That's supposedly where this came from. And meridional, I don't know. I'm just the messenger here. But anyway, if you think about these then as water as being the light blue and the chlorine as being that, that would be a place where mare and fac. So really, if we were to make this complex, we should identify it as mare or fac, CrCl3H2O3. But the wildest one of all, and what I want to leave off today with these lectures, is the optical isomers. Now, these guys are a huge area of science in chemistry, which has just exploded since the 1950s. As technology has developed, they've started to see more and more of these kind of effects and what to do with it. And it has to do with two different isomers that are so similar to each other, but they aren't quite the same. So an optical isomer is nothing more than two types of isomers, same number of atoms, they got something different going on in space, but it's a very, very subtle difference. So let's look at this one right here, all right? This is has a, let's say call this a carbon, we'll call white a hydrogen, I don't know, water, chlorine, bromine, whatever, all right? If we keep the black and white atom constant and you rotate the atoms around, all right, let's go the yellow this way, all right, yellow will end up here, pink will end up there and stuff like that. It's pretty wild. But what's gonna happen after a while, if you think about it, is you can have the opposite thing. Now, before I go into this, if you look at your own hands, all right, your hands have five fingers. You got a thumb and a pinky and those other fingers, like I saw Deadpool this weekend, long story, but anyway, these two, all right, same kind of fingers, right, but they're different, all right? Like, they are like mirror images of each other, but they're not the same, all right? Opposable thumbs, they always say in biology and genetics and stuff like that, all right? The thumbs are on opposite sides and the pinkies and stuff. So these are like mirror images of each other. If we had a mirror in the middle, they would look the same, even though they are different types. All right, you have a right hand and a left hand. These crazy things are like that. They're like mirror images of each other. So this one is isomer one, and this one's isomer two. And let's pretend we put a piece of a mirror in the middle. Here's the yellow, this blue, pink in the back, and white one right there. But they're different, all right? They don't transform to each other, all right? So for example, if we want this yellow to be like this one, we would rotate it there, and then it would be right there. But in the process, blue would end up here, and pink would end up right there. It's very common in organic chemistry, in a four-center thing, tetrahedral carbon, stuff like that, to have this optical isomer property, where they look the same, same number of thumbs, pinkies, et cetera, but there's like a mirror image between them, and you can't overlap them. They are different, and these properties are extreme, and I mean that sincerely here. So in these pictures, you have isomer 1 appearing a couple places and isomer 2. And what it's trying to show you is that you rotate it around and you can't get the same thing back. Optical isomers are referred to as chiral, all right? And chiral is Latin or something like that for handed, which means that you have a left and a right hand version, or they look the same if you think about them as a mirror, but you try and put them together and they're not going to be the same. Enantiomers is a fancy word for things which are chiral, all right? So enantiomers and chiral, for our practical purposes here, just mean that you have this handedness thing going on. If it doesn't have a plane of symmetry, a substance is chiral. Most importantly for us right here, take home quiz number 6. a molecule could have a chiral property or be an enantiomer if all 4 pieces around the central atom are different. So if you had CCl2H2, 2 chlorines, 2 hydrogens, that's not going to be chiral. If you had 3 hydrogens and a bromine, also everything is not different. But if you had a carbon with hydrogen, chlorine, bromine, and fluoride, or carbon with methyl, ethyl, propyl, and butyl, those would be the examples of the things that would have enantiomers. They would be optically active. They would be chiral. Here's an example of this mirror phenomena. All right, here's your hands. All right, and like, yeah, oh yeah, they're the same thumb. No, they're not, because if you're gonna have them the same, both the hands would face you, and the thumbs are opposite, and the pinkies are opposite. And molecules are the same as well. So again, here's a central atom. We'll say the gray one is carbon, with 4 types of atoms around it, and they're all different. All right, so again, bromine, fluorine, iodine, and acetyl. That would be crazy. But anyway, these are chiral, all right? They look the same in the mirror, but if you try to transplant them on top of each other, 2 of the atoms will always be different. So why this is interesting is because these crazy things, at first, no one could identify them. They have the same melting point, they have the same solubility, they react in the same way, as long as what you're reacting with doesn't have its own chiral properties. Very, very difficult to isolate. But man, do they have different interactions sometimes. And we'll talk about this a little bit. The first way that people identified with them is using plain polarized light. If you shine plain polarized light, which is not too hard to do, the one enantiomer will move the light off to the left, and the other one will move the light off to the right. And if the left one is off by 23 degrees, the right one will be off by its own 23 degrees. It's very, very wild stuff. In organic chemistry, you'll talk about this quite a bit. Here's an example of how you get plain polarized light. You just take a regular light, and light normally comes out in all different directions and stuff. But you can use a polarizing filter, which is used sometimes on car windows and sunglasses and stuff like that, depending on who you want. And you basically take all those different planes and you place it just in a 2-dimensional existence. So it has like an up and a down, but only along that one plane. And if you shine this then at these crazy enantiomers, you'll see then that you can actually see a difference. So here's the same plain polarized light, and we're putting it through a solution with an enantiomer, which again is just some kind of molecule that has like a left and a right. So if you do that, and your enantiomer is pure, then you'll see light going to the left or light going to the right. You'll see in organic chemistry and higher levels of inorganic chemistry, the D and the L notation. And the D basically means that the light will be rotated to the right, and the L means it's going to be rotated to the left. Dextrorotatory and levorotatory, and who knows where those fascist names came from. But anyway, racemic is another thing you might hear. Racemic means that you have just as much of the right-hand light as the left-hand light. And this is, unfortunately, as we'll see, sometimes very common. You'll have just as much of the left as the right enantiomer, just as much of the left as the right hand, and you'll see that can return some problems. So if you see a little D in L, that just means that that's the enantiomer that moves to the right or the left. Now, the problem is that you have to separate these things, and this was a really tough thing to do. So this is just an example of how you can separate out these crazy racemic mixtures. This is a complex ion here with cobalt, 3 ethylene diamines, and 3 chlorines. But as we're going to see in a little bit, 3 ethylene diamines, you can have a left or a right-hand version of it, all right? They look, in a mirror, they'll look the same, but you try and superimpose them, you can't. Well, what happens in this case is that if you take a chiral version of a reagent, this crazy thing, and you react it, the D only reacts with the D form. So you end up with a solid, which is easy to separate. You can filter it or decant or whatever, which is a combination of the D form of the cobalt and the D form of this weird anion. And the L form just stays in solution. So a lot of times when it comes to these compounds, you take something with a mixture of right and left, and you add a chemical which only has the right will only react with right or left. In this case, it's the right and right, but it can be the opposite way. There's a selective reactivity, and that's how now they're starting to separate these things out. Now, of course, you have to have pure this, which is not always trivial either and stuff, but it's getting better and stuff. Okay. Now, this is a very complex procedure to do because you have to have the pure chemical to begin with, the pure R, the pure L, and that's not easy. They're also very expensive because they're difficult to make. But the effects are, in my opinion now, mandatory to explore. And the two great examples of this are drugs that you probably have heard at least one of them, Ritalin and thalidomide, all right? Now let's talk about thalidomide first because this is the classic example. In the 50s and 60s, thalidomide was seen as a miracle agent. It would help women with pregnancy and stuff like that, and it supposedly made it really a lot better. And in Europe, it was approved for a lot of use, especially in England. But the United States, the FDA, had questions about thalidomide, and it was never approved for use in the United States. Anyway, long story short, thalidomide, when it was given to the pregnant mothers and their children were born, there were horrible birth defects. I mean, really, really bad kind of things. And as it turns out, thalidomide has this enantiomeric nature. There's a right-hand and a left-hand version. And I don't remember exactly which is which, but let's pretend that the right-hand version was a good version. It helped the women and stuff like that, made everything good. But the left-hand version, that evil twin, was the one that got in there and then caused all the serious birth defects. If you look this up on the BBC and stuff like that, there was just a couple years ago a huge payout to the mothers and children that had used thalidomide because the effects were just really, really bad. The funny thing, okay, funny maybe isn't the right word. The unusual thing is that now with our types of chemistry knowledge we have, you can isolate the good thalidomide from the bad thalidomide, and apparently the good thalidomide really would help out a lot, but who would want to use it because there are all these bad effects and stuff like that, and do you have 100% yield, blah, blah, blah. Kind of crazy. Now, Ritalin is a more recent example of one where apparently there is a good Ritalin and a bad Ritalin. And the good Ritalin is the one you hear about. It's the one that helps with children, supposedly with ADHD and stuff like that, kind of calm down. But there's also a bad Ritalin. And apparently Ritalin now has gone through serious revisions and purifications to make sure that the other version of Ritalin, which also caused depression and stuff like that, has been removed. So I think you're going to hear more about these. This is a brand new area of science. This is really tough stuff to do. You have to have very specialized equipment, pretty good financial base to just get the reagents to react with them in the first place. And then isolating them usually involves like crystal structures, which is also kind of a crazy thing. They have to take the solid and send a really pure sample away for X-ray analysis. So anyway, these are just some things that you might see in organic chemistry especially. This enantiomer nature has definitely affected my field a lot. And in organic and inorganic, knowing what enantiomer you have can be very important. It can be literally life-saving. Questions? I don't have a lot of time left, but I'm going to go through a couple of slides for things that really you can just take as informational only. If I had a couple more days, it would be awesome to go through this next section in detail, but alas, time is always on our side. On Wednesday, we'll start reviewing for the final exam. We'll talk more about what that's going to be about. But until Wednesday, let me take a couple of seconds and just advertise what's called crystal field theory. We've seen that some of these complex ions, they have four coordinates around them in either a tetrahedral or a square planar. And a lot of them are octahedral. A couple of them, like silver, make linear compounds. You can explain which type of coordination sphere these metals are in using this crystal field theory. It does a really great job talking about and explaining like why the colors appear in inorganic complexes and also the magnetism of the complexes. So crystal field theory is a really important part of inorganic chemistry and coordination chemistry. It's mostly focused on the d orbitals. So that's really been the whole gist of all the transition metals that we've seen so far. And when they think about ligands, they think of them as what they call point charges, which is just like a source of negative electrons. So it doesn't matter if it's cyanide or nitro or something like that. In this kind of field, they just want to know that something's there and they can know like what to do with it. It always assumes that you have ionic bonding and not covalent bonding. That's pretty important now. Ionic bonding is classic positive-negative interactions, but there is a lot of covalent bonding that can be done with metals and certain types of things too. And the reason I'm glad to go through this slide is that in organic chemistry, we saw how valence bond theory does a pretty good job, but molecular orbital theory was even better. But the problem in organic chemistry is that MO was so complicated. You need the TI-2000 calculators and stuff I was babbling about if you were with me then. In inorganic chemistry, molecular orbital theory is also superior. But if it was complicated with only S and P orbitals, the addition of d orbitals makes the complexity go up another order of magnitude. So really, if you're going to use molecular orbital theory for inorganic complexes, you would need the TI-3000 calculator, right? Something like even more powerful than the TI-2000. So there's analogies between crystal field theory and molecular orbital theory in inorganic chemistry versus valence bond theory and molecular orbital theory in organic chemistry. And if we all had the ultimate calculators, computers, MO theory would win out over both crystal field theory and valence bond theory, but a lot of times the complexity makes that non-possible. Crystal field theory works really well just like valence bond. These are the 5D orbitals, all right? We saw these briefly in Chem 221. Four of the five look kind of like two figure eights put together, all right? This one is different because the orbitals are right on the axes, usually the X and the Y if you define them this way. This one right here, it's not the best picture. I called it the donut orbital in Chem 221. There's like a little donut that kind of goes around this central one. Stuff is kind of cool. Anyway, these are used a lot in crystal field theory then to explain how electrons come in. And it does help you to figure out where the orbitals are. If the bonding is occurring in the X, Y, and Z orbitals, these two right here are going to be really important to chemists because this is where the electrons are, the electron density. You need to have electrons to make bonds with other ligands. And if you have them at weird angles, you won't have very good bonds with the ligands. These guys especially will sometimes make really good bonds because that's where the glue is. Now, electrostatic interactions is a term that means the positives and negatives and how they come together. And in Chem 221 through Chem 223, we use Coulomb's law to describe how positives and negatives can be stronger and weaker. And crystal field theory is no exceptions to that. It's always going to be the interaction between the positive metal and the negative ligands. Remember, a ligand is nothing more than a Lewis base, a source of electrons. And those electrons will be negative and they come together. However, when they come together, some of those orbitals will be lower in energy and some of those will be higher in energy. All right? For example, if I'm big and negative and I come to Melissa here, negative energy, Melissa's like, all right, her energy has changed. Now Daphne and Sam are far enough away, they're not really affected, all right? So some of these five orbitals will be changed in energies as the negatives come closer, and some of them will be the same. And that's kind of the basic gist of this crystal field theory. Those lone pair electrons on the ligands are big negative sources. And they'll come into orbitals. And if the orbital has electrons there, there's going to be a weird interaction and other ones won't. The crystal field then of crystal field theory is nothing more than how the lone pair electrons on the ligands are interacting with the lone pairs on the metal. And it once again comes down to electrons and electrons repelling. Repulsion makes the energies go up. But not all d orbitals are affected in the same way. So like I said earlier, poor Melissa, you're negative energy. But Sam and Daphne are like, whatever. All right, because they're like not as affected by it. So that's kind of the gist of crystal field theory. You see pictures like this. This is the positive metal, and these are the negative ligands, and it's their interactions which make it. I am definitely running out of time, so let me go through. Oh, cool pictures once again. Here's the orbitals. But eventually, you're going to have diagrams like this. This is a crystal field diagram. And again, this is just for information. But there are five d orbitals, and in the gas phase, they're degenerate, same energy. As you apply different ligands, then some of the orbitals will be a little bit lower in energy, and some of them will be higher. So in this case, this has higher energies up here and lower ones. The difference between these orbitals is what's used to explain the energies of transitions. There's these delta values. But anyway, I am way out of time. It's really cool stuff, but alas, so much more to do. I will see you either at one of the final lap times tomorrow, or I'll see you on Wednesday. Have a great day.